Good morning. Today is, if I find the right sheet, I'll know. Today is March 24th. This is the Education Subcommittee for Ways and Means. Welcome to everyone here. We have a comprehensive agenda today. We are looking at a work session for the state school fund and then also continue public hearing on Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And so we are going to start first with a work session on House Bill 5017, the State School Fund. I believe all documents are on OLIS so that people in the audience can follow along. And Mr. Wilson probably burned the midnight oil to help us get this very clear and articulate memorandum out for us this morning.
Madam Chair, for a process issue or question here, or not a question, but a process check, the work session documents are out there. There's my memo, which I'll walk through, which outlines, basically takes care of it. There are two runs based on the co-chair's proposed budget. One is for school districts, one is for ESDs. And there was a dash two amendments posted last night, which reflect the co-chair's budget. And we just posted the dash ones, which means they have to be posted for an hour before we take action on them. So I think your plan, Madam Chair, if I'm not mistaken, is to walk through as much as we can get to that point and then probably go to heck for a little while and come back.
Yes, well, okay. Mr. Wilson, my preference is to go through documents about the state school fund while they're all fresh in our minds. Okay. And seriously, we will obviously not be taking a motion at this time. And we'll take, Ben, we'll have you swing into your presentation and we'll... And you just posted this at 8:40, so at 9:40 that will only give us we can see how long it takes us and get through the motion and the amendments. Yes. Please.
Hey, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, from my memo, this reflects the co-chair's plan. This, of course, is the state school fund budget, represents roughly 40% of the general fund lottery fund budget for the state, so it is by far the biggest budget that we passed out this session in terms of dollars. The recommendation by the co-chairs, and which is reflected in the LFO co-chairs, is $7.255 billion for the combined general and lottery funds. You can see in the table on the first page the comparisons for various time periods dating back to the actuals for the current biennium or previous biennium 11-13. When you combine the state resources along with the various local revenues, they total roughly over $10.3 billion, roughly, going out to school districts and ESD through the state school formula. So the local revenues are property taxes, common school fund, various timber taxes, and the formula with the combined revenue sends money out to serve roughly 567 students. And when you add the various weights that Mr. Reeder went through, I believe last week, dealing with special education, poverty, a number of other things, the ADM weighted is just around 700,000, of which the formula distribution is based on. And the local revenues total roughly $3.5 billion between the school years. As you know, as Mr. Reeder pointed out, there were a number of distributions before funds are distributed to the school districts and ESDs. Sometimes these are called carve-outs, but I'm not sure exactly what the history of that term is, but it is the common usage now. I have a table on the next, on the second page of my memo, which basically describes those distributions or carve-outs. The first one deals with the local option equalization grant, roughly $2.9 million. These are updated figures just in the past week based on the levies that are currently in place. There's a high cost disabilities account. Current law has that at $18 million a year. The co-chairs in this budget added sufficient amount to make it $35 million a year in terms of distribution. So their 7255 number reflects that additional $34 million. The facilities grants in the co-chairs framework and plan is assumed at $15 million. This is a reduction of $5 million. So that means that $5 million would be distributed to the school districts in ESDs, the reduced $5 million. Both the high-cost disabilities account and the facilities account will take permanent law changes in another bill, but they're assumed in what you see before you. Then there are long-standing distributions, virtual school district, $1.6 million, ESD testing assessment contract, that's capped at $968,000, an amount that's been around for a few biennia. The new carve-out from last session for the Network of Quality Teaching and Learning, this is a total carve-out of approximately $35.4 million. It's in three parts in the distribution formula. $5 million is taken off the top. And then after the funds are distributed between school districts and ESDs, 95.5% to school districts, 4.5% to ESDs, another 15.2 million, I believe, taken each from that school district pot and the ESD pot. Then there's the talented and gifted programs, the speech language pathologist distribution or carve out, and finally there's a series of distributions for long-term care facilities, pediatric facilities, and Oregon School for the Deaf. Those total roughly $30 million, and they really represent the state school fund share for the students that are in those institutions or in those in the Oregon School for the Deaf. And finally, this one also requires another bill to delay or remove a sunset, and that would be the small high school district supplement for $5 million. So those are the various existing distributions or carve-outs.
Just a second, Mr. Wilson. Representative Huffman. Oh, he changed his mind. Okay.
I was trying to send a message to Senator Thompson, and it didn't work.
Okay.
What did you want?
John wants you. So much for discretion. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Okay, continuing on.
It's Jay Leno's night, so.
Should just passed a note.
There are two new carve-out or distributions in this plan. As the bill stands now, there will be one-time carve-outs, but there is ongoing discussions to make them permanent carve-outs, but that will take a separate bill or two, depending on whether they're combined or not. There is a bill dealing with the first one, and I believe the number is $34.99. This one relates to an English language learners program. So a total of $12.5 million is distributed to the department, who then will turn around and make grants or provide technical assistance to early learning programs. A number of districts will be identified based on criteria developed by an advisory group. They will be generally lower performing school districts in terms of their success and performance in ELL programs, and the funding is thought to provide about assistance to 30 to 35 schools, and that represents $10 million of that 12.5. Going to those 30 to 35 schools, an estimated number. Then the other 2.5% will be used to implement a more statewide ELL program, providing technical assistance, best practices, support and implementing the plan, a statewide plan's recommendation, and that would get 2.5 million of the total 12.5 million. And the budget report will have more detail on those for the committee and the members to look at in full. The second new distribution is one for nutritional programs. This will total just under 2.4 million. And this will provide a school lunch to no charge to those students who are currently eligible for reduced price lunches. Reduced price lunches. So that is a total of about $2.4 million. The co-chairs did add that $15 million, or just less than $15 million, to the overall number. At this point, I'd like to note two series of distribution runs that are out there and make sure you understand the differences. The ones provided by LRO are listed on or are on OLIS for your review, and those have been out there in the general distribution for a while since late last week. And then there are the ODE runs, and they post them on their website. And I first want to thank the department staff that worked quite late last night in getting a new run out. Michael Elliott, Michael Wiltfong, and other folks in the department. They deserve some kudos for working on that to get that out. That has been posted late last night on their website. And the two runs are slightly different. Not too much different. The assumptions are similar but slightly different. They try to go on basically a current law. So there are the small high school grant program, the additional high cost disabilities grant, and what they call a reserve count or a holdback are not included in their distributions of their in their runs. That is the primary differences between. If you take a look at the overall difference in the first school year of next biennium, the 15-16 school year, I think I got that right, there's about a $58.5 million difference between the runs in LRO and ODE, and these are the ones that were posted last night. And the reserve account represents $20 million of that difference. The high-cost disability grant change represents $18 million. And then the small grant, high school grant is another $2.5 million. That leaves roughly about $18 million in difference between the two. Put that in perspective for that school year. That's less than one-third of 1% difference. So it's relatively small. And it's mainly around some small differences in the assumptions around local revenue. LRO estimates that in local revenue will increase roughly 5%, and LRO is looking at effectively about 4.5%. And so that is the major reason for that relatively small difference. Again, thank you for the department for working last night on those on their runs. So going back to the memo after a quick drink here. That is water. I'm on page 3, and I want to go through the differences between the current service level, which is $6.777 billion, and what the co-chair's plan, and which is reflected in our recommendation, is. There are about 10 differences, and I'll go through those rather quickly, but they are in the memo in front of you. The first one is an estimate of full-day kindergarten. It is added at a cost or a representation of $220 million. This was an estimate that the department came out with and is partially based on the QEM model. The second difference is that the $100 million that were added during the 2013 special legislative session is included and then rolled up over a two-year period and adjusted for the various factors like inflation and compensation changes. I will note, if you printed this memo out before about 8:20 or 8:25, there was a mistake on number two. It said 2016 legislative session. It should have said 2013 special legislative session. The third point, as I mentioned before, is a high-cost disabilities account. The co-chairs added another $34 million in their number, and that will be reflected in another bill to make that a permanent change, but that brings that amount to $70 million. It still does not pay for, it's estimated not to pay for the whole cost to districts of high cost disabilities, but it increases it significantly. And then the facilities grant, as I mentioned, is also reduced from $20 million to $15 million. Two new distributions, which I've gone through already, are added at a cost of just under $15 million. As I mentioned, the local option equalization grants account have been updated to based on the current levies. That amount now is roughly $2.9 million. The total amount of state school fund is split evenly in these assumptions between the school years, 50%, 50%. That is different from previous biennia, or at least this current biennium. And the bill also includes a trigger so that the difference between the forecast in May of 2015, this coming May, and the previous forecast that was released in February, which is often referred to as the March forecast, the difference, if it's positive, will automatically appropriate an additional 40% of that difference to the state school fund. The remaining 60% will be left in the general fund for distribution on other priorities that the legislature decides on, but will likely include other education programs, public safety programs, and human service programs, the big three in the remaining portion of the budget. So that's an important factor, is that trigger. There is language in the amendment reflecting that in the dash two amendments. Number nine, as I said before, this basically sort of lays out the $7.255 billion figure. This represents about a 9.1% increase over the 13-15 amount for the state school fund, and is about 5% greater than what the governor had included in his recommended budget. If you include the local revenues, the total amount going out through the formula is estimated to be about $955 million more than the 13-15 estimated. That's the combined state resources and the local resources. And finally, this doesn't happen in this bill, but just to make sure you understand, there's always or almost always a difference between an adjustment made in the end of session bill between general fund and lottery funds to balance whatever the lottery fund forecast is and other uses in the budget. It's usually a revenue neutral or resource neutral amount, but it's just to shore up how much lottery funds are in the overall state budget. So, Madam Chair, our recommendation, which is reflects the co-chair's plan, is in a general fund appropriation of $6,912,858,941, a lottery fund expenditure limitation, and that would also be an allocation of $342,141,059, and other funds expenditure limitation of $3,260,692 for a total there of about $7.258 billion. Just a quick note, the other fund expenditure limitation there, about $400,000, reflects revenues that come to the state through some certain timber programs. And then the remaining $2.9 million reflects the local option equalization grants. The money that we take it out of the state school fund, it's deposited in the fund, and then it is sent out at the districts, and you need the other fund limitation to do that. And the recommendation also reflects a 50% division between the first year and the second year. And that, Madam Chair, is my presentation for you.
Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. A couple of comments and a question. The trigger is something that there's been quite a bit of discussion of. 40%, if there is an increase in the May forecast over the March forecast, 40% of it goes into the Common School Fund. And we ask how much that could be. And the answer we got was anywhere from zero, that 40% could be anywhere from zero to 200 million additional. So if you're looking at the 7.255, it could be plus up to 200 million. The question I have is about something I think I heard Doug say on the small school distribution. I think you said we have to pass a separate bill or that gets sunsetted, goes away.
That is right, Mr. Chair, and I believe that bill is in Senator Roblin's committee right now. I don't remember the number of it.
Yeah.
I have a suggestion for amending it.
Oh.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
I just have a question. So I'm new on this committee. So in this budget, we have $60 million to decide on later in the session on the which governor's proposals we're going to be doing.
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, for the Department of Education's budget, we split it in two parts. There's the state school fund, of which you're addressing today, and that is only those funds that flow out through the school revenue formula. And then the remainder of the budget, which would be that $60 million plus quite a few hundred million also, will be dealt with later in session.
As we go along.
Yeah, so this is only the state school fund budget.
We still have more fun to do after we pass it. Yeah.
I want to take a brief recess because I need a little bit of consultation. So, brief recess, members. Okay. So now, how do we do this? There we are. We're back in session, and what we're going to do is, at this time, we are going to close the work session on House Bill 5017 and open the public hearing on 5024. And Mr. Cannon, you're going to keep us on the edge of our chairs with telling us more about HEC, right? And Mr. Wilson probably have been talking till about 9:30. What do you think?
9:30 or 9:35.
Probably. Okay. So you have 30 minutes.
Great. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. And somebody said I'll have to be really good this morning to take your mind off $7.25 billion, but I'll try. It is sort of humbling to present amidst consideration of the state school fund. Just for context, the higher education budget that's before you, recommended budget that's before you, totals about $1.7 billion. So just for some sense of proportion in terms of the state's general fund and lottery fund investment in K-12 and in higher education. One of the principles, since I'm on it, one of the principles that we've tried to apply to our preparation for this budget presentation is to allocate the time that we spend with you in proportion to the size of the dollars that we're recommending. So that will mean spending more time on our larger pots of money. It may, though, also mean sort of moving quickly through items that are of particular interest to you or over which you have particular influence. So please don't hesitate to slow us down or follow up if we're moving past items that are especially important. I want to point out that we've tried to respond to several of the questions that were raised in yesterday's committee. We've prepared a letter that you should have received, and we're happy to have any follow-up conversation that you may want to have offline or or within today's hearing about that. I'm going to jump right in, and the next section, we're continuing today with some overview before we get into the specific pots of funding that we'll spend most of our time describing to you. And left off, just as we were going to begin to spend a few minutes on the HEX workaround equity and commitments to an equity lens. And I know you were introduced, probably not introduced, but had some discussion of the equity lens with ODE's presentation. I want to note here that the HEC has adopted the same lens, and it has become a very important tool for the Commission to use to screen potential investments or policy recommendations for sort of their reflection of the principles that are within the equity lens. I think this is another place where the OEIB and its development of the lens has helped to really influence and inform the direction that the Commission has taken. One of the things that's especially valuable to my mind about the lens is that it helps us get past the somewhat often squishy nature of conversations about equity. It's actually, and I'm sure some or many of you have looked at it, it's quite a remarkable document, I believe, for the rigor and precision with which it attempts to approach our equity work. I'll note that the Commission has established a sort of ad hoc advisory committee of chief diversity officers and others at our institutions who are focused at an institutional level on equity, and so they have helped to advise and will continue to help advise our work on equity-related issues. Just a few slides and data. This is our projections of our Oregon high school graduating classes by race and ethnicity looking forward almost 20 years. And you'll note here that we have we're projecting sort of stable size of Oregon's high school graduating class, not significant growth there, but changing demographics within it. And this slide contains some of the takeaways. As I noted, Oregon's high school graduating classes are not growing rapidly in total numbers, but are growing increasingly diverse. The fastest growing youth populations among Oregonians are among Oregonians who currently have low high school completion and college going rates, and that creates a particular obligation and opportunity for the Commission. You'll note here the increase in the Hispanic or Latino population from 19% to 24% of all graduates over the time, over that time frame. I mentioned.
Thank you. I was busy reading all the notes. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. You alluded to it, I think, Ben, but it certainly jumps out at me on this graph that the American Indian Native, Alaskan Native population as far as high school graduation is decreasing and projected out to 2034, and certainly there's some recent data out that I've seen that tells us we've got a serious issue there that we all need to bring all hands on deck to work on. But even out to 2034, how is that? What is the conversation about that, projecting out that far, that we're still decreasing?
Representative Springer, Madam Co-Chair, I can't speak to the projected number of graduates within that particular population to 2034. I'd be happy to follow up. It does appear, I mean, I read this the same way I think you do, which is that the total number of projected graduates within that group decreases, it looks like, slightly between now and then. I don't know what the basis for that projection is, and we'll have to follow up with you.
Follow up.
I appreciate that, and I can see the source here is not the HEC for this data. I would just want to say that certainly in light of the survey that came out, just a few months ago, and the fact that we have 9 Oregon, federally recognized Oregon tribes here, that should be increasing, definitely. And so I think that that's something we need to be intentionally aware of. And focus on, for sure.
Representative Springer, Madam Co-Chair, appreciate the point, and we'll certainly follow up about the extent to which this slide reflects merely sort of demographic patterns versus what I think you're pointing at, which is concerns relative to completion rates, right? And certainly anything that shows a diminishing completion rate or even not an increasing one it creates a real obligation and opportunity for policymakers, and I'll certainly follow up.
I wouldn't have had a follow-up if he hadn't said that. And I realize this is by demographic, not actual results of graduation rates. Regardless of the demographic piece, we have a lot of room for improvement with the population we have now. So we could increase that regardless of the demographic. We could increase that.
Absolutely. And actually, the next slide gets at our higher ed completion rates, and you've seen a version of this, at least the 40-40-20 on the left-hand side, and then our entire working age adult population in the middle bar, and this is sort of measured against the 40-40-20 categories or our approximations of it. The right-hand bar lumps together for the working age adult population of African American, Hispanic, and Native American Oregonians completion rates. So here's a sort of focused view of the gap and the opportunity around those selected racial and ethnic subgroups. And obviously, the bachelor's and associate's degree, the sort of upper and middle 40s, if you will, and I don't love those that terminology, but those 40s equal only 27% for those selected subgroups versus 48% for the entire adult population helps to provide a sense of how far we have to go. So I think your point, Representative Springer, is precisely correct. This you'll see a version of the slide later when we look more at work that the HEC is doing and recommendations around really focusing our investments in ways that support the economic needs of the state. This chart comes from the Department of Employment, and it's a chart that projects total job openings over the upcoming years by type of occupation and also by the education level that's required. Now, these are not this does not include every category of job for which there are projected or large numbers of projected openings. It does single out those with post-high school training and education requirements, but it helps to reinforce the idea that there will be jobs, and many of them, that require bachelor's degrees, advanced degrees, or some form of post-secondary training. And really, the one of the ways that our commission is making the case around the equity work and the equity lens is from a business case. And you see that in the next slide, which quotes Jill Island from Intel, describing the creation of their new diversity and technology initiative to help support their goals as a company to sell, design, and sell products to consumers, and to do so by more closely mirroring the face of America within their own workplace. And this, we think, is representative of an employer focus on increasing the diversity of their employees, and for companies like Intel, of course, that means of college-educated workers. Finally, and I won't go through these quotes, but I will say, relative to equity, I think if we're honest, we'd acknowledge that for a large portion of its ancient history, higher education has served to help harden and reinforce distinctions or barriers of race and class. That's the reality. Higher education has helped to harden and reinforce those barriers. We don't think of it that way today, and we shouldn't think of it that way today. And I think we share a belief and an understanding that particularly in the post-World War II period in America, higher education has been one of our greatest levers, if not our greatest lever, for reducing those distinctions of race and those barriers of race and class. But we need to remain vigilant on that, and particularly in the face of rising income inequality throughout this country and diminishing affordability of higher education, it's critical that we remain laser-focused on higher education's results for lower-income students, Pell students, and underrepresented minority students. That this is a sort of profound obligation and ought to be a profound concern to policymakers. It certainly is to the HEC moving forward, so that we can maintain our belief that higher education is in fact a lever for opportunity and not a not a barrier to it. You heard yesterday, moving forward, you heard yesterday from John Tapunia and Greg Heyman about the return on investment for higher education. And I don't need to spend a lot of time on the following data points because they'll be familiar to you, but they are important nevertheless, and I do want to touch on them. So first of all, earnings or expected average wages by level of educational attainment, not surprisingly, greater levels of educational attainment produce on average greater earnings for Oregonians and for Americans. Likewise, unemployment is lower. This data is now likely out of date insofar as our unemployment across all categories has diminished. But nevertheless, the relationship here between education and unemployment is still strong. These may look a little different than anything you've seen before. They attempt to express for different levels of education the earnings, which you just saw, but also taxes paid, both state and local and federal taxes. So you get a sense of the relative contributions of higher educated Oregonians to our public systems. And this sort of tries to put it all together with the green bar. So this now is really focused on returns to Oregon, to the public, through tax revenues as well as through avoided or savings on social services, criminal justice, and unemployment expenses. So the gray bar are the state's investment in the education of the student. So at every level, we've invested as a state. The public has invested in the education of Oregonians. It's invested more for Oregonians who go to attend higher education, and since many of those have much of that has occurred in public settings. The green bars are those returns, returns both in terms of tax revenue, as I said, as well as savings on social services and the like. And so I think the place to look here is in the relationship between the gray bar, the size of the gray bars, and the size of the green bars. And you'll notice that at levels of educational attainment beyond the high school diploma, that return on investment to the public, to the state of Oregon, positive. So our returns become greater than our investment for Oregonians who have earned an associate's degree, bachelor's degree, master's, professional or doctoral degree, and of course significantly higher at those higher levels. All right.
I like the other picture.
Yes, sorry. This was our placeholder slide for the discussion that John and Greg had with you yesterday. It is a nice one.
It's a great picture.
So what we'll do over the next few minutes is turn our attention back to the actual budget recommendations that you've been presented with and start to dive a little deeper, understanding that we're still at the highest level and much more detail is to follow. So we're going to look at the major components of our budget, and I'll start again with an overview chart. You saw a version of this, or actually the same slide, yesterday. I mentioned a couple of things yesterday, and this is the governor's budget on the lower bar compared with 2013-15 legislatively adopted budget on the top bar. I mentioned that this is governor's budget, not co-chair, so the co-chair's framework includes significant additional proposed funding in the community colleges and public universities buckets, a slightly less funding in the financial aid bucket, and is largely silent on the rest. I said a few things about this slide yesterday. One thing I didn't say was the smallest slice here at the far right-hand side. That reflects primarily investments in the HEC agency structure. There are some programs, including Aspire and others, that you know that are supported by that staff. And it also includes sort of the core operational funding for the agency. And that reflects about 1.7% of the total budget in both of these slices. And we'll be talking, you know, quite a bit more about that on the, but not till much later in the presentations. This reminds you, but now starting to get in somewhat more detail, of the major categories of funding. So this slide reflects about 85% of the higher education general fund lottery fund budget, and it's in just a four major categories: financial aid, public university support, community college support, and debt service.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kump. I just had a question regarding the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Is that money available to students for both public universities and private universities within Oregon?
Representative Taylor, co-chairs, yes, it is. There are restrictions on what types of private institutions that funding is available for, but generally independent colleges and universities in the state, private independent colleges and universities, their students are eligible on the same basis as public university and community college students.
Follow-ups. Thank you, Chair Kump. Can you just explain a little bit more about which schools would not be allowed to apply for that, and what the currently, I know there's been some changes in that program. I just wanted to have you update me, please, on what the high-level criteria is for who's getting the money versus not getting the money.
Representative Taylor, co-chairs, the students attending a private institution that is based in Oregon and is nonprofit and accredited are eligible to receive the opportunity grant if they qualify. Qualification is on the same terms as students attending any public institution, which is income-based, so you have to qualify using the criteria that the commission has adopted under rule, actually OSAC adopted, and the previous commission, and that the HEC inherited, and is, you're eligible for only a certain number of years. We don't have enough funds to cover the program. We're going to be talking a lot more about this either most likely starting tomorrow, but we'll go into quite a bit of detail around the opportunity grant because it is such an emphasis of the commission's. But generally speaking, it's an income-based program. That is the primary determinant, and the way that we have triaged the fact that we have the program, given that we have limited dollars, not enough to serve everyone who qualifies, is by applying an early deadline and rewarding those who apply first. What we'll describe to you starting tomorrow is a proposal to change the way that we triage to really focus on the neediest students, and that's work that's coming through. We hope the House Higher Education Committee down here, but our budget reflects that emphasis as well.
Thank you.
So these are the major categories of funding. You see the packages that are associated with the increases that are proposed in the governor's budget. And as I said, these four categories reflect about 80 or constitute 86% of the total higher education general fund and lottery fund budget that is proposed for your consideration. So we started to talk, and this is really previewing the more detailed discussion of our recommendations around affordability. The commission's highest priority in its advice to the governor and now to you relative to education investments is affordability. And we'll have a lot more to say about it, but there are really three prongs that the commission has identified to get at the affordability issue. One of them is an expansion and a strategic redesign of the opportunity grant that I just alluded to. Another is to increase institutional funding and to focus that funding, and we'll say more about what that means, but increased institutional funding that's focused on student success and keeping tuition levels manageable. And finally, an emphasis on helping prospective students and family plan for post-secondary success. And so some of the work that we do is really around preparing for succeeding in higher education.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. So the second one, what does that mean?
So, Representative Springer, Madam Co-Chair, the second one alludes to a couple of things. One is the proposal that our budget contains for increased funding for our community colleges and universities, increased support funding. But this also alludes to the work that the commission is doing to change how those dollars are distributed to campuses, to more clearly reward and incent their achieving outcomes for students, not merely enrolling them. And that's there's a section of the presentation upcoming that goes into somewhat more detail around that, and we're happy to come back in phase two, as the co-chairs and Doug have suggested, to describe our work on the formulas to really essentially align the dollars with the outcomes that we're seeking for students. And the way that we're proposing to do that is through the new distribution formulas for the community colleges and the public universities.
Thank you.
The opportunity grant package that you will hear quite a bit more about proposes to expand the opportunity grant funding by nearly 26% and redesign the program to focus on the highest need students to help them successfully complete. It would expand the number of students who we serve by about 16,000, and it would target those who have the greatest financial need. It would improve predictability by guaranteeing students a second year of continued funding year over year, as long as they remain eligible and make satisfactory progress. And it would extend the application period to allow for, in part, that increased predictability and more students to take advantage of the grant. So we'll have more to say about that, but the takeaway here is we are proposing to both increase the grant and focus the grant.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Maybe you'll get to this and talk about this a little later. I've gone through and I haven't seen it on a brief look here. One of the things that we're just now beginning to talk about a little bit, and I think we need to talk about a whole lot more, is the idea of, and I realize that the financial aid really creates an incentive, federal financial aid creates an incentive for 12 credit hours per term. 12 credit hours per term means 5 years. A fifth year is super expensive. Mm-hmm. We have penciled out those numbers for our son and said, this is how much that fifth year is going to cost somebody, you or I, you and us, and second, how much money are you going to lose because you're not earning a living that fifth year? So we've got to, I think, really begin pushing 15 credits. My goodness, there were times in college I took 20-some credits because I did the math and figured out what credits were kind of free, and I realized it was done differently then. But what credits were basically free and how I could work out the cooperative work experience and consider that not a class, extra time, something I was doing anyway, to get done to save money. I think we've really got to be hitting that 15 credits a term a lot harder.
Representative Springer, Madam Co-Chair, I'm so glad that you asked the question because one of the...
There was a question in there?
Well, I'm too glad you made
I thought it was a speech.
You made the statement and gave me the opportunity to touch on that because one of the provisions in House Bill 2407, which is our opportunity grant redesign bill, would permit the commission to establish a supplemental award, a supplementary opportunity grant, if you will, available to students who complete 45 credits in an academic year, meaning 15 a term if they're not taking over the summer, precisely because of what you've described. We're concerned, and many states are, that too many students are achieving full-time status through and full-time financial aid by enrolling and completing 12 per term or 36 per year. And as you pointed out, and you're exactly right, that is not enough to finish in four. So we're provisionally calling this program, which would require the adoption of House Bill 24-7 and then subsequent action by the commission, we're provisionally calling it finish in four. And if we can create a financial incentive or, frankly, holds students sort of harmless for spending the additional tuition dollars to go from 12 credits to 15 credits, at most universities, there's some additional cost for that now. at all universities, we're saying, hey, that's the smart move, and as a state, we should be invested in that, particularly when your eligibility for the opportunity grant ends after 4 years. So you take 12 credits a year, you're a full-time student, you get 4 years of an opportunity grant, 4 years potentially of a Pell Grant or other federal financial aid. Lo and behold, you're not done with college, and your financial aid is gone. So what we couldn't agree more, Representative, and that's why the bill looks the way it does, and we look forward to talking about it with you.
And Ben, I have a quick question. We're looking at additional 25% expanding of grants. So I'm thinking that this is already March, and I mean, how does this impact the grant opportunities for next, walk me through the timeline and who would be eligible for grants this fall, much less the other.
Representative Comp, I'm going to bring Bob Brew here to describe how this works. It's a good question about the interface between this proposed expansion and how that would affect students this spring applying for the fall.
Thanks, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Comp, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Bob Brew. I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Student Access and Completion. So right now, students that completed the free application for federal financial aid in January, they're applying for September. So we've sent a letter to the co-chairs of Ways and Means requesting permission to go ahead and begin allocating funds to be distributed in September, essentially ahead of the budget approval process. And I think we've used the governor's recommended budget as our starting point. So we've said we're going to allocate 49% of the governor's recommended budget to the students that are applying now in January. Now, of course, those dollars won't go out the door until the new fiscal year, and by then the budget will be set. However, we have to, because we're kind of obligating funds, we had to do that in advance. Did that answer your question?
Sure did. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ben, if you can kind of bring to a conclusion here in 2 minutes.
Yep, sure. So I think my takeaway on this slide, and we'll talk a lot more starting tomorrow about our proposals around the Opportunity Grant and investments in higher education affordability. But our takeaway around the Opportunity Grant is increase it and focus it. Likewise, our takeaway around institutional investments, increase them and focus them. The increase is your responsibility to determine how much. We have recommendations. The co-chairs have some numbers. The focusing is the commission's responsibility in consultation with you to consider how those should be and determine how those should be allocated. And again, we'll describe the work that we're doing to shift the way a portion of those dollars will more intentionally follow and reward student success. Just to conclude, and there are these slides, the next three are somewhat detailed, but they basically use the same format to list out the remaining approximately 15% of our budget and the major chunks included within it, including Aspire. And here there's a little bit of mixing and matching because whereas I've been previously focused exclusively on general fund, these slides do begin to bring in some federally funded and other funded portions of our budget, including Aspire, which, for reasons we'll describe later, is we have a proposal to shift some of the funding there to federal funds. Workforce Training, which is a major federal program that the HEC administers, a community innovation package that's in the governor's budget, general funded. Capital projects here, the request is for bonding authority, debt service, which we mentioned previously, OHSU, some university programs that you'll have a day on in a couple of weeks, and finally are the major offices within the HEC umbrella. So these slides are, in a sense, a reference point for you as you are looking to get your hands around this budget, which, while not the size of the K-12 ODE budget, does have its own versions of complexity and scale. So I'll stop there, and thanks for a continued conversation.
Thank you. And the comment I would like to make is a big thank you to you and all the people that have been working with you on this, for the past, it seems like only 3 months, but it's probably about 18 months, and you've made huge strides, so thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 5024, open a work session on 5017. Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Do you have a motion?
Do you want me to make my motion first?
You do whatever Doug tells you.
Okay. Whatever Doug tells me.
Why don't we do this motion and then go to your two members?
Okay, Madam Co-Chair, I would move that House Bill 5017
Madam Chair,
be amended.
This one right here.
Okay, I move that move the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation on House Bill 5017.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The motion is to move House Bill 5017 with the LFO recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair, technically, just to make sure, you're moving the LFO recommendation, and then you will be there will have to be an amendment to the bill, which is sort of the official action.
Okay, so
you have a motion on the floor for the LFO recommendation.
Okay, we have a motion on the floor for the LFO recommendation. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is probably as good a place as any to insert this. There was a term used recently, foolhardy, and so I think I'm going to use that here. I think it would be foolhardy on my part to ignore our education partners and be a yes vote on this or the dash one amendment that is coming next, I assume. You know, we listened to hours and days of testimony. There was, to the best of my memory, only one school district that came in and testified that it would not be a cuts budget at 7.235, what we were talking about during those hearings. The additional $20 million has also been testified that it wouldn't make a difference to the school districts. And, you know, I reject the idea that all of a sudden school districts don't know how to budget. They've been doing it for quite some time, and I think I trust them to know that it's going to take quite a bit more than 7.255 to make ends meet and not be a cuts budget. Most of the school districts, though not all, said that the 7.255 would be a cuts budget. A lot of them were rural districts. I'm not going to say most, but a lot of them were rural districts that I keep an eye out for. And Madam Co-Chair, I just cannot go along with a budget that's going to cut my kids more days, add more kids to the classroom, and cut teachers. I just can't see how we can sit here and do that.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. Like most of us on this, this is my first time on this budget committee, and probably like most of the rest of you, I think I had about 400 emails. Mostly, I answered them myself. So I just wanted to read one that kind of says it all, I guess. And let's see. This comes from Rich Truax from Hood River. As you are aware and are hearing from many Oregon voters, we are very concerned regarding the 10-plus year slide of Oregon's K-12 education funding. Our concern includes the fact that Oregon now resides at the bottom ranks nationally of K-12 funding per pupil, instructional hours, and graduation rates. For 10 years now, K-12 funding in Oregon has received less, while other areas of the budget have received more. That simple. There are always competing needs, many of which are worthy. Nonetheless, your current 7.255, now it's 2.35 when they wrote it, proposed 15-17 budget for K-12 will continue the decrease for Oregon's K-12 kids. It doesn't even maintain past budget levels. This budget will result in continued reduction of teachers, programs, and services at Oregon school districts. You have heard the responses from large urban districts, such as David Douglas in my area, who may lose several tens of teachers' positions, as well as rural districts such as my hometown district of Hood River that will also lose teacher position services and programs. This proposed budget that appears to be fast-tracking through approval will further damage our entire state's K-12 program. This email is a respectful suggestion and invitation that you sit down together to discuss ideas on how funds could be shifted to K-12 at a bare bones minimum with a goal of a $7.5 billion K-12 budget. Such a budget might just allow Oregon's K-12 to hold steady rather than slide further downhill. In addition to our kids' interests, this obviously has business and economic growth impacts as business employees consider locating in Oregon and impact to their families. That's just part of the email. And I know, I mean, we've all sat in this committee together for weeks now listening to the K-12 budget. And if we could get together, I'm sure, and find enough to at least get to 7.5 if we're not getting the pressure from above to come up with the 7.25. I know this committee can do it because everybody in this on this committee has worked hard, and I know we could find those numbers if we just, if they put us in a room, we could do it. So let's ignore the co-chair's 2.235 and do it on our own. So I'd be for that.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Co-chair Monroe, do you mind waiting to hear a couple of?
That'd be fine.
Representative Smith Warner and then Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to take a moment, first of all, to thank the LFO staff for the work. I know this is one of those situations where there are, every day it seems as though we're getting a new variety of numbers based on a new variety of assumptions. And I think that is something that is that we hear a lot of in here. And I believe as somebody with two kids in public schools, I feel good about passing a budget early and giving some stability and ability to plan to these districts. I think we can't overlook the fact that as I've heard said, is this a game-changing budget? No. Is it a stability budget? Yes, it is. It is, I mean, the numbers are not made up. This is a 9.1% increase over the 2013 legislatively approved budget and 5% more than was in the governor's budget. I think there's significant items in here, not to mention the increased local revenue element. Is this where I want to stop? No. Is this where I want to provide a baseline and keep working like heck for the rest of the year to find more, whether it's the part of this bill or everything we continue to do, as Senator Thompson suggests, to find more as we go? Yes, I think that's really important. And I think it's really important to pass this to make a significant contribution to moving forward on this discussion.
Representative Taylor.
Representative
Springer, please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'll briefly reiterate a couple things that were said as far as my email inbox, talking about what the budget does or doesn't do, frankly, at 7.235 or any number close to that. I think less than 7.5 is an issue. That said, I hope I keep looking at this this conversation in a broader context than just here's the pot of money. What's more important? What are the priorities, or what has to be done? Which is a very valid, real part of the conversation. That's the conversation that takes place at the Springer dining room table monthly when we go through our budget. How much is in the pot and where does it need to go and what are the priorities? Is cable or satellite a priority? Are different things priorities? And sometimes we get those and sometimes we don't. But the other conversation that takes place at the Springer table is, are we doing all we can to maximize our income potential? And that's a very, very important part of the conversation, not just here's the budget, this is what we can do with it. And I've seen this body, unfortunately, maybe I've been here long enough now that the frustration's building a little, but we've said no to opportunities to grow our pot. So I think as we look at the priorities of where we spend, let's not forget, because I hear the pushback a lot, well, what's more important? That's a fair question, but just as fair of a question is, what are we doing in this state to grow our pot? What are we doing to bring business here and keep business here? What are we doing to help people with their income potential or get out of the way for them to maximize their income potential? Yesterday, I felt we passed a bill. Lots of different pieces go on here, but we passed a bill, and one of my comments was that really frustrated me is, we're picking who wins in this paradigm, and it's the mom with the single mom with the kids that took it in the shorts, quite frankly, I think, yesterday. And we do that sometimes in this building. So let's keep in mind that we look at both sides of the profit loss, the budget statement, not just how we spend the money and prioritize it, but what are we doing as a state to either get out of the way or support people to grow their own income, which this is an income tax dependent state. I think that's important to remember.
Thank you, Representative Springer. Representative Taylor, did you want to comment? Or
yeah, thank you, Chair Comp. I agree with Senator Thompson in that, and frankly with all the members that I've gotten to know since being a freshman here, that I'm very impressed that education definitely is a priority in this building. And I think we're demonstrating that as this body, that we're basically giving the majority, or we're allocating the majority of the state money to education. There are some other positive things that are coming out of the budget that I wanted to mention. Doug mentioned them a little bit earlier, but we do have a commitment from Speaker Kotek and from President Courtney that if there is additional revenue, that we will be seeing approximately 40% of those funds going to the school districts. So we want to hope for growth in the economy and that there'll be additional funds there. Some of the other great accomplishments that have occurred approximately 5 years ago, before my time, this body voted to pay for full-day kindergarten. And we're going to be able to provide that. And it is my understanding that something around 100% of the school districts are saying about 100% participation rate is expected, which is really that's an enormous accomplishment for our state. And we're also recognizing that we had some problems with how we were allocating funds regarding English language learners, and we're correcting that with some of the adjustments. We're also making some corrections on how we do the high cost disabilities, and also regarding the helping low income students with the reduced meal program. So there's definitely room for improvement. I personally am a big fan of the quality education model, and that, of course, is somewhere, maybe Senator Roblin knows the exact number off the top of his head.
2.9 billion.
More we need. I was going to say 2 billion, so I was close enough.
Very close.
That we need. And so there's that's a big sum of money, and we know that there is a model there. We know what we need to do. We know we need additional revenue in order to fund that, and this is a strong baseline budget. We all live through the harder times, and so I'm hoping that we can pass this out, that hopefully there will be a trigger that we can send some more money, and then, of course, I'm more than happy to join Senator Thompson and others in trying to find additional sums. It's a hard thing to do, but I'm more than happy to participate in that. So I just wanted to add that, Chair Comp.
Thank you. Co-Chair Monroe?
Well, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Please don't think of this process as the end of the game for school funding. It's the beginning. Now, why are we doing it now? Why not wait until May or June? School districts are budgeting right now. I spent 10 years on the board of David Douglas, and I was chair much of that time. And budgeting has to be done early. And so we always wanted to get our budget out by early April. So what do you budget on? You need a number that's firm. You need a number That's a floor. You know it's not going to go any lower. And that's what this budget gives you. This is a current service level budget, not a cuts budget. Look at the runs. I looked at David Douglas, for example. David Douglas, with this number, gets $100 per ADMW more than they have in the current year. And the current year was the best funding year for schools in a long time. And then the second year of the biennium, they get an additional 100. And that's if we don't add anything through the trigger mechanism, or we don't vote to keep the kicker or anything else. That's just this budget. So this is a current service level budget. It's not an add budget, but it's not a cut budget either. It's a budget that the school districts would be assured they're going to get, guaranteed, and hoping that there's more. We always pass a Christmas tree bill at the end of the session. Always, always. I've been here for 40 years. We always pass a Christmas tree bill at the end of the session. That Christmas tree bill is an opportunity to add to other budgets that we have already passed. There will be one this year. I hope it's substantial. But even if it's not, this is a budget that schools can lean on, rely on, and function on without cuts. It also does something that I've been in favor of for a long time. It funds full-day kindergarten. Full-day kindergarten is critical. Study after study shows a dramatic difference in readiness for those students that have had a full-day program versus the two-and-a-half-hour half-day program. So that's a significant change. And the nutrition. If you've ever been a teacher, you know that if kids come into your classroom hungry, it's pretty hard to teach them anything. So providing free lunches and breakfasts for every student that is qualified for not just free but for also reduced is a dramatic step, a dramatic addition. There's a lot of good things in this budget. It's not as much as I want it to be, but it's a good start, and it's a good sound foundation for school districts to build upon, to count on. You know, when you're out there working and you have a job and you know you've got a certain salary that you can count on, and then you get a little overtime and you get a little additional, that's nice, but at least you've got that regular salary every week or every month that you can count on. That's what this is. This is a regular salary type current service level budget. Look at the runs for each one of your school districts, and you'll find in every case they're up from the current school year. And remember, the current school year, we dumped a bunch of extra money in. It's higher than it's been in a long time. So, ladies and gentlemen, this is something we need to do. We need to give the school districts out there certainty. And then we need to work to try and find additional money before we go home in June or July.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I share with my co-chair a lot of things that we don't even have to talk anymore. It's like he and his wife, but he says everything I'm thinking, so saves us some time. With that, I'm going to have you call the roll, and the motion is to accept the LFO recommendation.
Senator Roland?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Monroe?
Aye.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
I'm gonna switch to no.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Co-Chair Comp?
I and our good friend Senator Thompson decided he wants to change his vote.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Motion carries. Co-Chair Monroe, our next motion. Oh, I want to do Senator Thompson's amendment here first. Senator Thompson, did you have an amendment?
I do have, Co-Chair. I would like to move the Dash 1 amendment.
Okay. The motion is to move the Dash 1 amendment. Would you briefly tell us about it?
You want me to just read it?
Well, I don't know. How long is
it? It's pretty long. But
no.
I don't want to read all. Basically brings the budget up to about the K through 12 budget up to $8 billion and says that we may spend $1.6 million from the state school fund for purposes related to the Oregon Virtual School District also. Those
okay.
are the two most main points.
And do you have a copy for all members? And it is on OLIS.
Madam Chair, it's posted on OLIS.
Yeah, okay.
It was posted in March.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's on OLIS.
Okay. Any discussion? Senator Monroe?
Can I ask the good senator how he's going to pay for the additional 700 and some million dollars that this amendment would require?
I'll give you a snapshot because we're still working on some proposals, and I don't want to get political fact until we're absolutely sure that some of the things could work. But just a snapshot of how you get to 7.5, we came up with a few ideas. Let's see, we're paying for five Cover Oregon attorney fees, $35,000 each. These are little, you know, if you go into the budget, you can find all kinds of stuff. And Governor Kitzhoffer and Sylvia Hayes, that's $35,000 each for their fees, and I believe that's an inappropriate use of taxpayer funds. We're subsidizing the Amtrak rail at $5 million. It's been talked about this budget that we could
eliminate. Senator, you might need to move a little closer to the
We could eliminate the Oregon Education Investment Board, that's $20 million. With the Elliott State Forest, it's due to environmental things, it's been grossly mismanaged and undercut the last few years. There's probably $80 million if we go back to just cutting it like Hood River County cuts it. And so there's $80 million. And to get it up to, this will be about $235. 2 years ago, state employees got significant raises. If we could freeze the salaries this time around, it'd be about $129.7 million. So right there's $235, and if each of us came up with $235, there'd be I'm sure we could do that if we all go back and think about it a little bit. There's more, but we gotta do a little political facting first.
Okay, thank you. Senator Roblin.
One slight correction, just so I could put it on the record, because the $80 million you could get from increasing the harvest on the Elliott Forest, which I would love to do, actually goes into a reserve fund, and only the interest comes out. So we wouldn't be able to use the $80 million in this particular biennium because of the way the trust fund works. But that being said, what I really wanted to say, first, as a principal who's worked in a budget situation where they actually didn't give us the budget until almost August 1 year, and we had a 7-period day. We had to go to a 6-period day. We didn't get a chance to talk to the kids as we cut their schedules down and the other things we did. For me, having an early budget is really important, and so I'm really happy we're having a conversation today. And I had a Republican friend when I was in the House that brought this up every year, that we need to get the education budget out first, and I am really appreciative that we're going to be able to do that this year. I have been trying to figure out how to get enough money to increase this budget as well since I got on this committee. And like my good friend, this is the first time that I've actually sit on this committee. However, a few years ago I had the opportunity of being the Speaker of the House with another Speaker, a friend and Republican, and we had an opportunity to cut $3 or $4 billion out of the state budget, and it was one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in my life. And we did it because we talked to each other and we looked at the budget and we made really difficult decisions, and it hurt schools a lot. And we all know that period of time. But I also came to understand that there's a larger budget and that you can't cut one place without hurting another. And I listened to a few of the suggestions we had there. But I went through the budget and talked to my budget people and asked them, what do we really have to do to cut to get $700 million. And that's what we're talking about, $700 million. And I know what it was like to cut those other budgets, and $700 million is an amazingly large number in our total budget with respect to when we're already underfunding a lot of different parts of our budget. So here's what I came up with. We could eliminate OHP dental coverage. It also lose about $257 million from federal matching funds. And that's another thing that has to be taken into consideration whenever we make a cut. We could close Junction City State Hospital, eliminating 240 jobs. We could close prisons in Salem, Tillamook, Portland, and release prisoners. Close prisons in Baker, Lakeview, North Bend, and Salem. We could eliminate 100 state troopers. We could reduce employment-related daycare. We could cover 25 fewer lines of OHP prioritized list of services, eliminating $135 million. Within that, we would also lose another $1 billion in federal funding. And those are the kinds of problems that we have. And I don't know, I mean, this is a list that gets me close to the money I want. Instead of losing, and instead of cutting $700 million, we also lose another $1 billion in federal funding. And those are the conversations that each of those co-chairs are making and thinking about right now. And having sat in a position where we had to agree to those changes, my co-chair and myself, you have to weigh those things. I love education. It has been my life. I would love to do whatever I possibly can. And I think that going and putting out a budget of $7 billion is not a responsible way to move forward in a really difficult time we have. And I understand it. I would love to be able to give that kind of money to our schools, because I know what it means to each and every one of the kids that are out there. But at the end of the day, we have to be responsible for an entire budget that includes a whole lot of different things. And albeit this is difficult for me, and albeit I've talked to almost all my superintendents in my district, and I have a lot of superintendents in my district, that are talking about the kind of things they have to do. I know, because what Mr. Huffman said at the very beginning, these people have been making budgets and doing the hard work for a long time. It's not fun, it's not easy, but they will make the best decisions they can at the local level to do with whatever we end up giving them. And having a decision to be able to do it now, as opposed to later, is singularly the best thing we can do in a difficult situation. So I appreciate where we're at. I will be a no on this amendment, but and those are some of the reasons why I will be a no.
Thank you, Senator Roblin. My years of being a school principal tells me many of the same things that you shared, and the key part of all this is our base amount. After the forecast, or as we move through the budget, if there's other additions we can put in there, our commitment is to build that, such as Senator Thompson has considered and shared, and so that our schools know this is the floor, and that we can build from there. So, Representative Springer,
thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm not going to miss this opportunity to spotlight, frankly, my own comments, which is whenever we have this conversation in only terms of cuts, right, it's a very uncomfortable conversation. Therefore, I am constantly trying to broaden the conversation to growth, mm-hmm, and to areas that cut expenses. And I think that this was just a great illustration of that, because I think we all sat here at one point or another and went, ow, that's uncomfortable. But we get to broaden our conversation to more than just that. And I encourage us to continue to do that with our policies.
Thank you. I appreciate your comments. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Cuts are uncomfortable, but at some point we do need to prioritize. And I do appreciate the fact that I've always advocated for passing the K-12 budget early, so they school districts do have certainty to know what to budget with. But again, if it's not enough money, they can have all the certainty in the world, certainty that they know they're going to be cutting. And I do believe this is a cuts budget. The recommendation by Senator Thompson, though, I don't think we just have to look at cuts. We do have to prioritize. I think most of us around this dais were told last year, for those of us that had to campaign, education, jobs, and economy. Those were the things that always came up at town halls in conversations with constituents. So at some point, I think I need to prioritize and say, okay, my constituents that told me that are serious, they want K-12 as a priority. Therefore, these other things over here probably aren't quite the priority, and that's where the tough decisions come in. We also have a projected roughly $1.8 billion in additional revenue that we're going to be looking at if revenue projections are close. So it's not all cuts. We do have additional revenue, and maybe instead of starting some shiny new programs, we should say no to some shiny new programs and fund the current stuff that we got that needs to be funded properly.
Thank you. Senator Roblin?
Just a quick one, because I actually agree with a lot of what Representative Huffman says, and I talk to a lot of people, and I recognize education is really important too. But since the 1990s, when we really made the decision to move from property tax to the state funding for education, our voters have spoken repeatedly about their priorities, and they haven't always been education. They've been prisons and safety. They've been property tax reductions. They've been, the list goes on, issues with respect to the kicker and how we spend money. All of those decisions that our voters have made have impacted our budgeting process and the ability that we have to have revenue come in to spend in the things we want to do. And they've spoken enough that some of those things are in our Constitution. Therefore, they have put those at a priority that's higher than the priority I would have for education, which is number one, because I always thought we took that vote as a population too, but we had a Supreme Court ruling that said that that wasn't the same kind of priority that some of these others were. And so I absolutely agree, but it's difficult sometimes when our voters have spoken in some ways that limit the ability of us to get the revenue we need to make it the priority that we have. And I don't want that to go without being mentioned.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Thompson.
Every time Senator Roblin mentions that about the tax measures, yes, that was. But I got to throw in the 90s, we quit cutting federal timber also. And that would be, there's the other way we get our $200 or $300 million is if we can get back in and cut our federal timber. So I got to throw that in.
I know he agrees.
I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go cut trees. I've been working on it for a long time. So thank you.
Representative Smith-Warner, and then we're going to take a vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to say briefly, the other great balancing thing that I'm doing this year is I'm serving on this Ways and Means Committee and also on the Revenue Committee. So I would say to Representative Springer's point, I think she is right on. And I think there are opportunities for us to look at what our revenue sources are in this state, who pays what, particularly when we are ranked somewhere in the low 40s and we have a very unstable tax base, and we are ranked in the very low 40s on corporate tax rates. We're having a lot of conversations there about, indeed, that is another place that we perhaps can and should look about what our priorities are for fairness in revenue, as well as trying to prioritize our spending.
Yeah. And I would make just one other comment that Senator Monroe and I have been co-chairing this along with 1 year with co-chair Springer. And what I've learned over these 6-7 years, however many years it's been, we have had the opportunity to have two of the best, I think, I'm biased, co-chairs that help our presiding officers look at this from every angle. And I think they are to be commended. I believe that the Department of Education has gone above and beyond to work together to get matching numbers so that school districts, when they finish the day, they know how much money we're going to be voting on. So those are really critical pieces, and my appreciation to this whole committee, because what we do is not easy. Today I'm wearing a Christmas gift, and it has names of all my grandchildren and my 3 great-grandchildren on it. And I wore it purposely because they're the reason I'm here, and they're the reason that I want to continue to learn and to get to that $8 billion number. But it's not going to happen overnight. We got to keep working at it. It's like anything else. And so with that, I need to take a vote, don't I?
Yep.
Okay, Julie, would you take the vote on the dash twos?
Dash ones.
Dash ones. Thank you.
Senator Rowland?
No.
Senator Thompson?
Yes.
Senator Monroe?
No. No.
Representative Smith Warner?
No.
Representative Taylor?
No.
Representative Springer?
Yes.
Representative Huffman?
Yes.
Co-chair Comp?
No.
Did it pass?
No, motion fails.
We could
do a recount, but it's not going to help.
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes.
I move the dash two amendment to House Bill 5017.
The motion before us is to move House Bill 5017 with the dash two amendments.
No, we're moving the dash twos to put them in the bill, Madam Chair, to make sure we get it right.
Okay, then we get the final
one. Get another vote.
Yeah. Right, okay. Now, did you want to say that for the record so it's clear?
We are voting on the amendment, the dash two amendment, which sets the number at 7.255 billion, with the other provisions that we've gone over in terms of full day kindergarten being paid, and in terms of the trigger, if there's additional money, 40% of it going to this budget, and the nutrition stuff and the other things that we've gone over all in this dash two amendment.
Thank you, Co-Chair Monroe. Any discussion? Julie, will you call the vote?
Senator Rowland?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Co-Chair Monroe?
Aye.
Senator Smith, or Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Aye. And now for the full...
Madam Co-Chair, I move House Bill 5017 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
The motion has been made by Co-Chair Monroe to move House Bill 5017 to the full committee as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Co-Chair?
Yes, sir. Representative Huffman.
Is a due pass really appropriate? I mean, isn't that a little more akin to having more agreement on the committee? Just curious.
Madam Chair, this is our standard motion in subcommittee. So.
I'm just questioning the standard.
I'm going to say yes. Thank you. Any other discussion and questions? Okay, Julie, will you take the call of vote?
Senator Rowland?
Aye.
Senator Thompson?
Nope.
Co-Chair Monroe?
Aye.
Representative Smith Warner?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
No.
Representative Huffman?
No.
Co-Chair Paul?
Aye. Motion carries. And before we conclude the day,
and Madam Co-Chair, I'll be happy to carry it.
Yes, Senator Monroe will carry this to the full Ways and Means, and that meeting is tomorrow?
It'll be Thursday at some point.
4 o'clock.
Today, is Tuesday? It 4 now? Okay.
I think 4 o'clock Thursday was the time I heard.
So we will take the motion up in the full Ways and Means Committee. And tomorrow we will continue with HEC.
That is right.
I can't believe I'm saying that word, but it is higher education. So, and I want to again just thank this committee. We will keep working on seeing if we can't find other ways to increase this amount, and that all of our school children deserve the best we can give them. And that some of us may not feel this is quite the best, but it's really the best we're doing at this day on March 24th. We're adjourned. Oh, did I close the...